Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating the history of the Bosnian War between 1992 and 1995, and we'll be investigating the ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and the long-term legacy of the conflict. We'd love you to join our discussion. Text call 30 cent. The number is 53106, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed Shakespeare's Anthony and Cleopatra, explored the history of Kylemore Abbey, and heard about the hype man behind Muhammad Ali. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on the Bosnian War. Between 1992 and 1995, a bitter and brutal war was raged in the former Yugoslavia between three factions, Bosnian Muslims, Serbs and Croats. The conflict became infamous for the ferocity of the fighting, with ethnic cleansing, genocide and an horrific level of abuse and human rights violations. It is estimated that 100,000 people were killed before a peace agreement, the Dayton Accords, was finally signed. In tonight's show, we want to find out why the conflict broke out and discuss what exactly happened, including the terrible human rights violations and the destruction of cultural heritage, and then explore how the conflict came to an end. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Sinisha Milesevic is Professor of Sociology at University College Dublin and is an expert on the study of war and organised violence, ethnicity, nation-states and nationalism. And his books include The Rise of Organised Brutality, A Historical Sociology of Violence. Dr. Helen Wallasek is an honorary research associate, is an honorary associate research fellow at University of Exeter, and is the author of Bosnia and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage. She was deputy director of Bosnia-Herzegovina Heritage Rescue, the only heritage NGO accredited as a humanitarian aid organization operating in Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. And her field trips in 2000 and 2001 with archaeologist Richard Carlton were the first post-war assessments of damaged and destroyed historic monuments throughout the country. Retired Colonel Colm Doyle of the Irish Army was seconded to the European Community Monitoring Mission in the former Yugoslavia in 1991, where he played an important role mediating, negotiating and persuading leaders on all sides. He arranged ceasefires, visited prisoners of war camps, extricated election monitors and organised hostage releases. His experiences made him a key witness at the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague, and he's the author of Witness to War Crimes, The Memoirs of a Peacekeeper in Bosnia. Dr. Balázs Apor is the director of the European Studies MPhil programme at the School of Literatures, Languages and Cultural Studies at Trinity College Dublin, and he's an expert on Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century. Dr. John Paul Newman lectures in 20th century European history at Maynooth University and is an expert on the modern history of the Balkans and East Central Europe. And he's the author of Yugoslavia in the Shadow of War, Veterans and the Limits of State Building, 1903 to 1945. Well, you're all very welcome. And Colm, I might begin with you because Martin Bell, who reported on the war, has called you a prime witness, perhaps the prime witness for how the war began and how it developed. And I wonder, could you explain to our listeners just what exactly went so horribly wrong in 1992?
Well, first of all, thank you very much in your program, Patrick. It's a pleasure to join you this evening. When I went to Bosnia in October 1991, the conflict hadn't arrived there at that stage. But Bosnia was very much being influenced by what was happening in Croatia. I think all of this whole crisis really goes back to the time after the death of Tito, you know, when Yugoslavia experienced a kind of a dysfunctional political system and an economic calamity of the 80s. Communism was losing its potency, and the new leaders of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia and Franjo Tudjman in Croatia, they came to power. Now, if you were to take the whole Federation of Yugoslavia as an entity, the largest ethnic grouping within that were Serbs. But if you broke up the Federation, as happened with Slovenia and Croatia and Bosnia, you'd find that the Serbs became a minority in some of those states. And the whole idea of the Serbs was that whatever was to happen in this conflict, they would try and join the territories occupied by Serbs, the joining with Serbia to become Greater Serbia. So for the Serbs, they did not want to become a minority in any of these republics. And whatever about the ethnic mix in Croatia, it was always going to be catastrophic in Bosnia. And so it played out. So that when I went there in October 1991, I was deployed to the city of Banja Luka. And within 6 weeks, I found myself in the capital, where I was asked to take over as the head of the mission. And from then on, it was sliding down a path which was to lead to dreadful conflict.
And you've written so powerfully about that experience. You were respected by all sides, but yet, despite all your best efforts, meeting with political and military leaders on all sides, you weren't able to stop that path to all-out war. How frustrating was that?
Well, I'd have to say it was very frustrating, because I began to realise, as did the team I was with, that no matter what peacekeepers try to do, or negotiators, or mediators, unless the parties to a conflict have any intention of going down the road of mediation, unless they're determined to try and come out of a conflict of this nature with an aspiration for peace, whatever a mediator can do is going to be senseless. So we found that even though we negotiated at a very high level, and when I was involved as head of the mission, I was speaking with Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Ilija Begovic, the leader of the Muslims. We felt at all times that regardless of what we were doing, these people were bent on a conflict. And as time went on, this thought we had gathered more momentum. And for the Bosnian Muslims, once they were given sovereignty by the European Union, which happened, I think, around the 6th of April 1992, they were convinced that the international community would come to their assistance by way of a military intervention. So as time passed, I think the Muslims became less interested in peace talks and more determined to get military intervention, which was never going to happen in any case. So despite our best efforts, we were very frustrated by thinking, no matter what we do, these ethnic groups are on the path to conflict and there's little we can do to stop them.
John Paul, I wonder how far back we can look at the roots of this conflict, because when we examine the fears, the prejudices, the animosities, you could possibly go back all the way to the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation tonight, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here. I think what Colm says is precisely right. He identifies the culprits who are most responsible for the violence, people like Radovan Karadzic, people like Slobodan Milosevic, to a certain extent, people like Franjo Tuđman. Their political decisions, their policies were the sort of the immediate catalyst for the conflict in Bosnia. But having said that, in Balkan society, not just in Yugoslavia, but throughout the region, there are a certain collection of stereotypes and tropes dating back to the Ottoman Empire, mainly based on these sort of national liberation narratives. These are spaces which sort of, in a sense, decolonized from the Ottoman Empire. So to a certain extent, the Ottoman Empire has been demonized. And in this respect, the Bosnian Muslims there were certain forces, certain groups which would look upon the Bosnian Muslims as something like collaborators with the old empire, apostates to the true faith, people who had converted or people who had fell away. They weren't the only attitudes, they weren't the only ideas to any extent in Balkan society, but nevertheless, at this sort of crisis moment in the 1980s, and the 1990s, those tropes and those stereotypes were readily instrumentalized and deployed by people like Slobodan Milosevic and people like Radovan Karadzic.
And Balázs, it's in that context that it's possible for these leaders to exploit the tensions, to build on that and present their own agendas and advance their own agendas. How exactly did the conflict erupt into open violence?
Yeah, thank you for the invitation, Patrick, and good evening, everyone. That's a very complex question because, as we know, the war in Bosnia was just one of the many armed conflicts in Yugoslavia and post-communist Yugoslavia. So there were many events happening, many conflicts happening at the same time in several places. So the war in Bosnia arguably started with the conflict in Kosovo in the late 1980s and in 1990. Then after the secession and declaration of independence by Slovenia and Croatia, there was a military conflict, a brief military conflict in Slovenia, and of course a war in Croatia as well. And eventually, when Bosnia declared independence in the spring of 1992, that of course escalated the conflicts and the ethnic tensions there, and that resulted in an open war. Now, war was of course brewing, and conflict was on the cards, as my colleagues have highlighted, that there were paramilitary groups that were already active by the time in various countries. The local Serb groups in Croatia and in Bosnia as well, they formed their autonomous republics, and they had armed groups and militias as well. We know that they were also supported by Milosevic, so resources and arms and of course people were going across the border. So it's a very complex phenomenon, but the direct cause of the military conflict in Bosnia was arguably the declaration of independence. That was probably the final straw that the local Serbian leaders that kind of convinced the local Serbian leaders Karadzic and the others to launch a more extensive conflict.
Sinisa, we could spend an entire year going through the various different stages of the war and the different twists and turns, and it's an incredibly complex and deeply upsetting conflict, given everything that happened. And it's hard to pin down some of the issues, because even the issue of ethnicity was very complex, and in terms of the different factions and how sometimes the fighting switched from one to the other.
Thanks very much, Patrick, for the invitation. Yes, that's very much the case. I mean, often these wars, and we have to bear in mind, I think Colm and John Paul are right in that sense, that these wars in Bosnia and Croatia were very much entangled, and they've often been described as ethnic conflict with lots of overemphasis on religion and not ethnicity. But we have to bear in mind that these people lived as citizens of a federal state, and these identities were very complex, and the reality of the conflict itself was very complex. So you often would find people fighting. And, obviously in the Croatian army, they're more overwhelmingly Croats, but there were other ethnicities. And in the Bosnian army, there was a majority of Bosnian Muslims, but there were also a lot of Serbs and Croats, particularly in urban areas such as Sarajevo or Tuzla. And even on the Serbian side, there were other groups, not to mention just volunteers also coming from, let's say, in Serbian side, we had volunteers from Greece and Russia. On the Bosnian army side, there were some volunteers from Arab countries and so on. And during the war itself, there was a lot of kind of shifting as the war changed. So some forces, initially would fight, let's say, Bosnian army and Croatian army, Croatian Council of Defense, which was a Croatian offshoot of fighting Serbian forces, and then they would fight each other until 1993. And then we had lots of paramilitary groups as well present in both wars in Croatia and in Bosnia. Some of them were voluntary forces, and some of them were highly indisciplined, obviously responsible for mass abuses and killings of civilians, and later on for all sorts of, systematic rapes and all these things. So we can say that in Bosnia particularly, this was a very complex fighting experience. We even had in northwest Bosnia, where a leading pre-war communist Bosnian Muslim leader, Abdic, established his own military force, People Defense of Western Bosnia, which collaborated with Bosnian Serb forces and to some extent with Bosnian Croat forces, and fought Bosnian
army, you know, which was predominantly Muslim. So in a sense, you had all these kind of complexities on the ground and mini wars happening at the same time, I think.
And Colm, given the level of hostilities and the level of anger and division and fear, it fed into then all of the various war crimes that the conflict became associated with: the ethnic cleansing, the genocide, the use of rape as a weapon against civilian populations, and again, these were things that you were an eyewitness for.
Yes, I mean, the methods that were used during the ethnic conflict, I mean, they included the killings of civilians, rape, those torture, destruction of civilian, public, culture, properties, looting, pillaging, and also the forcible relocation of civilian populations. And such was the degree of brutality that took place in Bosnia that the international community were moved to get the United Nations to establish a war crimes tribunal. Now, this is the first time this had ever happened. And I think when you have an ethnic war, it can be the most brutal of all. And I remember trying to do my little bit when I was in Bosnia, at the time I was in Sarajevo. I had thought that if you could have a strong political party that transcended ethnic background, it would have been an advantage. But the three main parties, the Muslims SDA, the Serbs SDS party, and the Croat HDZ, were all established along ethnic lines. So it was automatic if you were a Croat, you joined the HDZ party, or if you were a Serb, you joined the SDS. And I would have to say that I was rather dejected, because I went back to Sarajevo to do a television documentary 2 years ago, and the very same parties are still in power with much the same sort of leaders. And I said, I would have thought that in the intervening period, you might have a new party that transcended all of this ethnic background. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened. The only difference is that after nearly 30 years, we had 100,000 people who died. And that in itself was very sad.
Helen, you got to see some of the destruction after the conflict was over during your visits to the region. Just how bad were some of these attacks on villages and on civilians?
Well, I would say that the most destruction, I mean, the cities, to a certain extent, you know, there was destruction, but they survived as urban complexes. But when you would go to some of these villages, you know, the mosque would be totally destroyed, and all the houses would have their roofs gone. So it was in these, I would say the worst devastation was in the villages and very small towns. It wasn't, say, it was much more easily, absorbed in the larger cities like Mostar and Sarajevo.
And was a lot of the destruction deliberate? That, and we'll go on after the break to talk about the attacks on the cultural heritage. Do you think the attacks on religious heritage, the attacks on things like the National Library in Sarajevo, was this done deliberately?
Oh, it was definitely deliberate. It was definitely deliberate. And, you know, in small communities, religious structures were probably the most visible marker of a group's identity. And they weren't destroyed as part of a conflict, you know, part of a military conflict. They were deliberately destroyed. And it was very tied up with the whole process of ethnic cleansing. And in the larger towns and places where, like the National Library that you mentioned, libraries that were kind of symbolic of that ideal in Bosnia of coexistence and living together. So these were not acceptable to those who wanted a monoethnic society.
So the objective was the destruction of the other side. It wasn't about winning territory. It was about destroying people and destroying culture.
Bosnian Serb forces occupy 70% of the territory of Bosnia-Herzegovina. They said that themselves. It's not like, you know, someone's decided this. And in that territory, there was the minaret of every single mosque except one was destroyed. You know, so it was a very targeted at eliminating not only the people, but these structures that symbolized the people that lived there. And they all, I mean, the perpetrators themselves said it was also one to, they didn't, it was also to stop people from returning. So if they didn't destroy them in other ways, they destroyed the symbols of their identity as a community.
Okay, well, tonight we are debating the Bosnian War of 1992 to 1995. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about some of that destruction of the cultural heritage. We'll be also talking about why more wasn't done to try and stop the fighting earlier.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Bosnian War. I'm joined by Professors Sinisa Milesevic, Dr. Helen Wallasek, retired Colonel Colm Doyle, Dr. Balázs Apor and Dr. John Paul Newman. Balázs, can we talk about why it took so long for the conflict to come to an end and for there to be external intervention that worked? President Bill Clinton of the United States finally, I think, got involved in 1995. There was criticism of the American policy up until then. You had NATO airstrikes that seemed to have been successful at that point. Was there a failure of the international community to act more quickly, to act sooner?
I think yes. I think from a historical distance, we could. Come to that conclusion. The international community failed to respond fast and swiftly to the humanitarian crisis that was unfolding in Bosnia. But let's not forget that at the beginning of the 1990s, the international community had failed twice actually to respond to humanitarian crises and genocide. 1994 is actually the Rwandan genocide, and 1995 is, of course, the massacre in Srebrenica. So the international community wasn't really up to the task at the beginning of the 1990s to respond quickly to such situations. The other problem was that the solutions that were recommended in the 1993-1994 were actually solutions that considered the ethnic principle to be the most important feature and the future of Bosnia. So they wanted to divide Bosnia along ethnic lines, initially setting up cantons, then provinces, and then eventually the idea to split Bosnia-Herzegovina into three mini-states came up. But these were all rejected eventually by the various parties, so they didn't really lead anywhere. So it was 1995 when the international community eventually became a bit more assertive, but that also had to do, again, that had to do partly with the Rwandan genocide in 1994. From the perspective of Clinton personally, it also had to do with the approach of the American presidential elections in 1996. So that also explains his determination to put an end to the Bosnian conflict, but the situation, the military situation, also seemed to be turning in the favor of the Americans and the international community, and of course the Bosnians as well, with important Croatian and coordinated Croatian and Bosnian military offensives and campaigns launched throughout 1995. So by August 1995, in September, October 1995, the Bosnian Serb Republic and the army of the Bosnian Serb Republic was in retreat. So when it came down to convening the meeting in Dayton, quite famously, it seemed that a solution or an end of the war was imminent, irrespective of the nature of the solution that the international community would recommend. But we know now, actually, that Clinton, up until August, September, was still considering actually splitting Bosnia-Herzegovina along ethnic lines, and even after Srebrenica, it was considered an option to actually grant independence and autonomy to Republika Srpska, that is the Bosnian Serb Republic. And it was not until August and September when the ideas that eventually were agreed and accepted in the Dayton Agreement were crystallized.
And Balázs, remind our listeners about that Srebrenica massacre, because that happened in 1995, just as things were coming to an end, and it was one of the worst massacres of the conflict.
Yes, that is one of the most gruesome aspects of the Bosnian conflict, which took place in July 1995. That was again, and that should of course also be discussed in the context of Bosnian Serb campaigns in 1995. They were increasingly targeting United Nations safe areas or safe zones in Bosnia, and Srebrenica was one of them. So they were shelling various other safe zones, and eventually they also decided to attack Srebrenica. That was, by the way, another reason why the international community and NATO eventually decided to act swiftly. But as for Srebrenica, they unfortunately didn't respond swiftly enough and didn't approve the request for an airstrike after they learned that the Bosnian Serb army was approaching Srebrenica with the ambition or with the aim to overrun the village, which was a small or rather small Bosnian enclave surrounded by Bosnian Serb territories. And indeed, the territory was quickly overrun by the Bosnian Serb forces, and the UN troops that were stationed there, they were mostly Dutch soldiers, they were quickly evacuated there, and indeed the Bosnian army retreated from the area as well, leaving the civilians behind. And it was in the first few days of July 1995 when a large number of these civilians were executed and shot and buried in mass graves. The numbers, of course, will never be known, but it is suggested that around 8,000 people were executed, mostly men and young boys, and were buried in mass graves. A large number of people managed to escape through the hills as well to Bosnian territory.
Sinisa, you conducted extensive field research about the experience of war and combat with former soldiers. Can you tell me about some of the soldiers you met and how they reflected on the past and the violence of this time?
Yes, I interviewed a large number of former combatants in both Croatia and Bosnia. And it's also interesting, you know, often the emphasis has been on civilian casualties, which is important, obviously. But we have to bear in mind that most of these soldiers were conscripts, and they were obviously volunteers, especially in the early parts of the war. But later on, we have more and more conscripts, and, you know, these are usually very young soldiers who are 18, 19, early 20s. And obviously they had harrowing stories of facing death and witnessing their friends being killed and wounded and passing through destroyed towns and villages and, you know, witnessing all these dead animals and everything. What's also interesting is that, you know, many of them were really, you know, one day living normal lives. You know, as they would say to me, you know, I was in school or partying with friends, going to clubs, and next day, you know, I'm here on the battlefield, you know, experiencing all this carnage and death. And, you know, many of them were not trained properly. On the Bosnian side in particular, there was an arms embargo, so they didn't have weapons, and they had to improvise and deal with these horrific realities around them. So a lot of research has been done on the kind of these macro context of the beginning of the war and political involvements, but there hasn't been that much kind of research on micro experiences of ordinary soldiers. So much of my research really is on that experience of soldiers, and particularly conscripts and their stories. And, you know, this is something that we know more about only now.
And in terms of the difficulties in conducting these interviews, was it possible to get them to reflect on some of the terrible human rights violations and war crimes, or was it something they were comfortable reflecting on?
Yes, I mean, most of them obviously describe their own experiences as deeply traumatic, but what's also interesting, they show a lot of empathy towards other people, also people who fought against them, which is interesting, because this goes very much against the kind of narrative that you got in the media, and especially now, you know, it's kind of this reinforced animosity. But many of them, you know, have a kind of a degree of empathy for people who went through the similar experiences. So they don't really show much hatred, as media would often portray. And they, many of them are fairly anti-war now. They, you know, they lived through kind of terrible experience themselves. And they also have that feeling of being betrayed in some respect by their governments and by politicians in particular, because after the war, you know, a lot of people have benefited. They've got special pensions, particularly those who are politically linked in particular political establishment, and ordinary soldiers didn't really have these big pensions to rely on. And, you know, they suffer from PTSD and all sorts of other things. And the element that you mentioned, obviously, that experience of witnessing human rights abuses and torture and things like that. So many of them do reflect on these experiences. And, you know, there's also a lot of this sense that this was happening, but they themselves were not part of it. But they still feel a degree of shame, you know, that these things did take place and that their army is tarnished by that kind of experience. Sometimes they blame paramilitaries. Obviously, we know that militaries themselves were involved in these things. And there is that element of trying to detach yourself from these kind of systematic rapes and torture and killing. But most of them are aware that these things were happening. And I've interviewed Bosnian Serb soldiers in particular, and they feel a degree of humiliation in some respects. And they know, because of all these crimes, war crimes that have taken place and the whole experience, it's very difficult for them to kind of see themselves in a kind of positive light as they want to see themselves, because most of them were not involved in these crimes. That's the thing. And now they're all kind of put into the same corner, and that's what worries them, I think.
Helen, can we talk about the scale of the destruction of cultural heritage during this conflict? How great was it, and should it be seen as another form of ethnic cleansing?
I don't think it's a form of ethnic cleansing. I think it's a part of ethnic cleansing. It's just one, it goes hand in hand with all the other human rights abuses that were going on. So I definitely don't think it can be separated. And I dislike this idea of some kind of separate ethnic cultural genocide or cultural cleansing. It was ethnic cleansing. It was a war crime and it was ethnic cleansing. But it's very difficult to get a full picture of what was destroyed, because even now there's no systematic inventory of the cultural and religious heritage that was damaged or destroyed during the war. It doesn't exist. So we have reports from for instance, the various religious communities, and the Islamic community. Statistics are that 80% of the mosques that existed in Bosnia-Herzegovina before the war, so that was 1,144 mosques, were either completely destroyed or badly damaged. Mostly on territory held by Bosnian Serb forces. There was also destruction of Catholic and Orthodox churches and monasteries, but it was on a much lesser scale. But then, of course, you got in the cities, you'd have destruction of places that were symbolized to things like the National Library, which symbolized this sort of living together, this whole idea of coexistence. It's also, it was the evidence of coexistence were in some of these places, like archives and libraries, the documentary evidence. So that they were also attacked on quite a large scale. But it's very difficult to get full statistics. And the Institute for Protection of Monuments for Bosnia-Herzegovina, which no longer exists, but it did exist during the war and for a period after the end of the war. They did do a survey, but they acknowledged that they hadn't been able to visit most of the places that that they listed, and we found lots of duplication in it. So it's difficult to say, very difficult to establish anything firm.
Colm, again, you were the person on the ground during this period, and you write so movingly in your book about what it was like seeing some of these things and doing your best to try and prevent them. And your own firsthand experiences, I think, brought home just the horrors of what was happening during this time.
Yes, I managed to get permission from a from a Serb general, General Ustalac, who commanded the 5th Corps in Banja Luka. I managed to get permission from him to visit a prisoner of war camp that was run by the Federal Army in Manacha. And I managed to get in there with two of my colleagues to see about 360 Croat prisoners. They were military prisoners. But my goodness, the conditions under which they were being held were quite barbaric. And I met with a very arrogant major who was the deputy commander of the camp. And in the course of conversation, one of my colleagues who was French spoke with one of the prisoners who was a doctor. And he said, you should ask about three prisoners in confinement. So the French officer whispered it to me and I demanded to see these three particular prisoners. And the major reluctantly allowed me to go in and he took me into a stall, which was a cow shed. And there were three soldiers manacled in leg irons to a wall. It was quite incredible. And they were absolutely terrified. And I demanded to know why they were separated. He said that they had admitted to killing and that whatever we did to try and get a prisoner release, it would not include these three. So I remember leaving that camp quite silent with my two colleagues and all the way back to Banja Luka, we could hardly speak because of what we had seen. But in about 3 weeks, those prisoners were released. We sent a report off to the European Union and obviously some action was taken. But listening to the other speakers who speak so, you know, knowledgeable of what they have seen in Bosnia, I agree with all of that. One of the problems we had with the monitor mission was that under the terms of reference that we operated, we had to have freedom of movement and safety and security. And during the early months, we were able to move around Bosnia without any problems. We had police escorts with us. But then suddenly, from April 1992, we were not allowed to move as freely as we had up to now. And we suspected there was something going on which alerted us to this particular fact. And the first atrocity that I recall taking place was in a town called Belica. It was in northeast Bosnia, where the Federal Army put a cordon around this town and allowed brutal paramilitaries from Belgrade, under the leadership of a man called Arkan, that was his nom de plume. They were called Arkan's Tigers. They came in from Serbia, and when the Federal Army put a cordon around the town, they went in and they butchered the population. And it became a very famous incident because one Serb member of the presidency, a female called Belinja Klasic, actually went to that town and she gave a kiss to Arkan on the cheek. And that was shown in a lot of the media at the time. But suddenly, if we heard that something untoward was happening in a village or a town, and we went to the authorities and we said, we want to go to investigate, suddenly it became convenient for them to say, I'm sorry, Mr. Doyle, we can't allow the mission in because we cannot guarantee your safety. Therefore, you don't have the freedom of movement. And this really accelerated from the time that the international community recognized Bosnia as a sovereign state, which was in the first week of April. And from that time on, Serb paramilitaries were trying to ethnically clear the whole line from north to south on the east coast of Bosnia, which was the territory closest to Serbia. And when we sent our reports, we would say we were denied the freedom of movement and we weren't given safety and security. And I think that began to ring alarm bells. And after that, then the phrase ethnic cleansing became on everybody's lips. We all knew what it was. And that, I think, stemmed from the reports that were going in and then the United Nations established the War Crimes Tribunal. So all in all, where we started nice and quietly doing our jobs diligently, because, you know, as international monitors, we weren't tainted by history or by grievance. Whereas if you spoke to a Bosnian, it would be very difficult for them to give you an outline of what was happening because he'd tell you from his side, from the Muslim side, what was happening or the Serb side. But with international observers that we had, whose job was simply to observe and to report, And the fact that we weren't tainted by this history of grievance gave us a better understanding of what was going on. But it, as time went on, it began to get far more difficult, which made our job almost impossible.
Almost impossible. John Paul, can I ask you about Milosevic, the president of Serbia, because he was later charged with war crimes. I wonder what was his strategy during this conflict and what exactly he wanted to achieve?
Well, I think he had two strategies. I mean, first of all, there will surely be a consensus that Slobodan Milosevic was really the catalyst of not only the breakup of Yugoslavia, but of much of this violence that that preceded it. It was his policies, his prosecution of the conflict, his acts during this time, which created a lot of the a lot of the trouble. He was not the only culprit, of course, but I would say he was first and foremost. He was first amongst equals amongst this gallery of war criminals, and he was rightly, of course, put on trial for all of these crimes. But sadly passed before he could face justice. It looks like initially Slobodan Milosevic was making his rise in the Yugoslav political system. It seems to most observers now that his initial plan was to essentially assume the role that Tito had assumed in his lifetime, which is to say he wanted to become the de facto dictator of the entire country. After Tito had died, Yugoslavia was governed by a very complex, very cumbersome rotating presidency, and the cumbersomeness of this presidency was precisely to sort of prevent a new figure coming through. Tito was seen, Tito was felt to be a one-off. He could not be repeated, and then he should not be repeated. So Slobodan Milosevic, in the first instance, was manipulating these various political parts of Yugoslavia to try to assume complete power of the state. And I think his plan A was to become a new Tito, ruling with absolute power, essentially, over Yugoslavia. The reactions to his policies, particularly from Croatia and Slovenia, the resistance to those policies, and the ultimate breaking away from the Yugoslav Federation of Slovenia and Croatia, which was essentially coordinated in the summer of 1991. At that point, Milosevic sort of reverted to what I think would have been his plan B, which was essentially to sort of acknowledge that Tito's Yugoslavia could not be saved, that Slovenia that had broken away could not be brought back into the Federation. And now Milosevic's best hope was to create a sort of what was known as a Great Serbia, or a Greater Serbia, which is to say a new state, an expanded Serbian state, which would house all of the Serbs. Now the problem with that, and the reason why this strategy was so violent, or why it needed to be achieved with such violence, was of course because in places like Croatia, but in particular in places like Bosnia, as Colm and Sinisa have mentioned, the ethnic makeup, the Serbian population was so far distributed that it would be impossible to create a sort of clean ethnic tableau of the kind Milosevic wanted to create without forcibly removing, so ethnically cleansing non-Serbs, or of course killing them. So the situation, the genocide that Balas very clearly summed up, very clearly explained at Srebrenica, was essentially a sort of an example of this. The Bosnian Serb forces, which were basically under the control, more or less, of Milosevic, removing the last sort of non-Serbian ethnic pocket within an otherwise clean Serbian tableau. So I think that was his policy. Plan A, to try to become the new master of Yugoslavia. When that plan broke down, he wanted essentially to create a Greater Serbia on the ruins of the Yugoslav state.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break now and we come back. We'll talk about the attempts to bring some of those responsible to justice.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back. Now, Colm, we're almost out of time. You were a key witness at that International Criminal Tribunal and helped bring people like Karadzic to justice. Do you feel that perhaps not enough could be done to bring the criminals to the justice they deserved?
Well, I have to say here that, Patrick, that there was 161 people indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal. That's the amount of people that they wanted, and they got all of them. So from that point of view, you know, it had some success. Now, although I testified at four of the major trials in The Hague, you know, I didn't see myself necessarily as a prosecution witness, but I was simply there to tell the truth of what I saw, who I met, what was said and what transpired. I suppose I was fortunate that I had a very good archive of diaries, reports, agreements, and I had presented these originally to the tribunal in 95. In the case of Karadzic, I underwent 15 hours of cross-examination directly by him, which certainly was a great test of my memory. But most of what he was trying to say to me was ruled irrelevant. But I think the tribunal was very important as it afforded some of the victims their chance to tell their story in court and to give them some sense of closure, if not a solution. But I think in examining Bosnia over the last, you know, since this conflict started, Bosnia had an outcome, but it never had a solution.
Okay, well, Colm, I think that's a good note on which to end our discussion. I'm afraid time has beaten us tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Sunisha Milosevic, Dr. Helen Wallasek, retired Colonel Colm Doyle, Dr. Balázs Apor, and Dr. John Paul Newman. My thanks to my producer, Susan Cahill, to Peter Malloy and Sand. Next week, we'll be talking about Seamus Heaney, the women who helped shape Irish foreign policy, and life lessons from the great philosophers. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.